WBAI, New York.
The previous program was Economic Update with Richard Wolf, which is heard right after the WBAI Evening News, Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook. It is 7 p.m. Stay tuned.
And it is 7 o'clock. You are listening to radio station WBAI New York. Time, once again, for Off the Hook. The program is Off the Hook once again, coming to you on a Wednesday evening. This is Emmanuel Goldstein. I'm joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah, I'm here.
You're messing with the phone there.
No, I'm
is everything
using,
okay?
I'm using, modular jack.
Got a landline there.
Yeah. Well,
good
yeah.
for you.
No,
good
I know how
you.
It works, too.
In yeah. this day and age, boy, the horror stories I could tell you about what I'm hearing with landlines, but we'll get into that in just a little bit. Also joining us tonight, if I'm not mistaken, is Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
And Gila.
Greetings and salutations.
And Alex.
Good evening from Pennsylvania.
Where apparently there's a delay. Okay, well, we're all here, we all made it through the storm. Okay, everything is calm, I guess, right?
Well, yeah. it was a bit much. I mean, we got about 16 to 18 inches up here.
Uh-huh.
I feel like I literally shoveled about 4 tons of snow.
Uh-huh.
I was reminded of that song, you load 16 tons and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt, right? You know, remember that song?
No, but I'm sorry to hear about that. Anything we can do to help, or
it was pretty intense. I mean, it just felt like I was constantly shoveling snow order to get out, in order to get it off the deck. Everywhere it was massive up here.
I'm still angry about missing the conjunction. 3 days of cloudy weather, and it's gone. And next one will be in 2080, I believe, and it won't be as good as this one.
You'll have another chance to get home then.
Yeah, unless something else happens. I've been thinking about this. Supernova would be okay. That would be acceptable. If there's a supernova in the sky, and there's so many stars, that's certainly a possibility. That would make me feel better. Or some kind of extraterrestrial visit would be nice as well. Would make up for this missing once-in-a-10-lifetime event.
I'm surprised that we haven't heard of, or maybe I just missed, any news about a cult type of activity that was occasioned by this alignment. Remember what happened with Comet Hale-Bopp?
Yeah, but you see, the thing, Alex, the reason why you're not hearing about cult behavior is because we're in a cult right now. We're kind of within the whole Trump cult society. So you don't really hear about competing cults as much as you would have in the past.
Yeah, we're captive to the dominant cult.
Yeah, yeah. There's some kind of biological reason for that.
I mean, that makes sense, right? I mean, you get this sort of, we're in our own cultish echo chamber, in a sense, I guess.
Uh-huh. Let me remind people, we are doing this radio show, as we have done in the past couple of weeks. We will be doing Off the Hook Overtime at 8 p.m. on our Channel 2600 YouTube channel. So join us there. You can call us. You can call us. I'll give you the phone number now. But it's not going to do anything. You'll just get a meaningless recording if you call it now. But at 8 o'clock, you can call it and speak to us live. It's 802-321-HACK. That's 802-321-4225. It's Vermont area code, but it's not actually in Vermont because phone numbers aren't geographical anymore. If you have the kind of billing agreement with a phone company where you actually have to pay long distance to call because the number says 802 instead of, say, 212. Well, we'd like to hear about that. And if you could spare the change to call us later and tell us about that, we'd sure like to hear that story. But again, 802-321-4225 at 8 o'clock, Channel 2600 on YouTube. Now the phone number you should be calling is 516-620-3602. That's the number you can call. Pledge support to WBAI. You can do that anytime. Say Off the Hook is your favorite program. See what kinds of premiums they may have for anything you might be able to pledge. You can become a BAI buddy. You can pledge a low amount, like $5 or $10 every month, and really, really help us out and keep WBAI broadcasting at 99.5 FM in the middle of New York City. That is an amazing accomplishment. And if you recall, a year ago, it was almost taken away from us. But we're right back where we belong on the FM dial. So please show your support for this amazing gift that benefits all of us. 516-620-3602. You know, I'm going to want to talk about the whole SolarWinds fiasco that has been going on. And boy, this is an incredible story. It's an incredible story of hacking and insecurity and other things. Before we do, though, a couple of other things I'd like to get into. I know, Rob, you found a very interesting story concerning the COVID-19 relief package, which we're hearing so much about now. Is it happening? Is it not happening? Or are we going to get all $600 at once? Or are we going to have to spend it $1 a day? Is it going to be $2,000 now? All kinds of disagreements. But inside that agreement that was finally hammered out is at least one major surprise. You want to shock our listeners with that?
Yeah, there are a couple of surprises in this particular Christmas present, Emmanuel. The bill, there are so many different things that have nothing to do with COVID or stimulus or any sort of relief payments in this bill, because that's how things are done now. You can't get anything done unless you attach a bunch of crap that has nothing to do with it to get things to grease the pipes. But in this particular package, the spending bill that's been on everyone's mind, there are a couple of things. For one thing, there's a copyright proposal that makes it a felony to stream copyrighted content you do not own for financial gain. And that's a big deal. It is called the Protecting Lawful Streaming Act of 2020. And that will allow law enforcement to prosecute pirate streaming services, quote unquote. They are saying, and they are coming out in front of it and saying that they don't want to go after your average internet user with this. They want to specifically go after companies and entities that are basically promoting piracy for profit, for financial gain.
Let me see if I understand this correctly. So if I were to say, go down to the filing office and start a company, and then the next day, because I probably wouldn't have time that same day to do it, but the next day I actually start streaming episodes of Seinfeld and start charging, oh, I don't know, what do you think, $1.25 per episode? Is it
39 cents.
All right, a promotional deal, 39 cents for the first 5 episodes, would you think? Okay, yeah. And then $1.25, because I think that's really what the market will bear.
Okay.
You're saying, Rob, that makes me a felon? That kind of criminal mischief makes me, that's part of COVID-19 relief.
Absolutely. Up until this, that sort of activity would have been classed a misdemeanor. They wouldn't have liked that you're doing it, but you would not have been a felon. You would not have been, like, prosecutable at major levels by the feds. This bill makes it unlawful to provide a service that's primarily designed to show copyright infringing content, has no significant commercial purpose other than piracy, or is intentionally marketed to promote streaming piracy, which is an interesting set of words. And it's the sort of thing that I can see the powers that be getting all sorts of fun lawyery meanings out of.
What I don't understand is there has been so little time where members of Congress have actually been doing anything. When did they find time to get this all written up and inserted into this emergency relief program? Did anybody even hear them talking about this?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Senator Tom Tillis from North Carolina, who apparently is the force behind this particular chunk.
Tom Tillis. Okay, hold on. I'm on it.
Excuse me. Is it possible to find out, like, what any one entity stands to gain? Who's protected by this? Where do these penalties go? Do we know any more about the repercussions?
Well, the thing that I'm seeing looking at this article is that this is functionally, and correct me if I'm wrong, anybody, but this appears to be kind of a SOPA PIPA light type situation. This is, you know, a weird way to get that wedge, not a weird way, this is a way to get that sort of wedge foot in the door, and then it wouldn't surprise me if they tried to expand this to the broader scope of what SOPA and PIPA were trying to do. But yeah, like SOPA PIPA light, I suppose.
Okay, I got it. Senator Tom Tillis, he's got offices, Tom Tillis, he's got offices in Charlotte, Greenville, Hendersonville, High Point, and Raleigh, as well as Washington, D.C. Which do you want the phone number for?
All of them?
Take them all.
I'm not going to give you all the phone numbers. Come on, we only have
Raleigh.
Raleigh? All right.
The one that's 202.
Well, okay, I'll give you the 202 as well. But Raleigh, 919-856-4630, or drop by 310 New Bern Avenue, Suite 122. Washington, D.C., phone number 202-224-6342. If you feel like sending a fax, 202-228-2563. There, that's how you contact your elected officials. Ask him, what in God's name are you thinking? streaming, that's a priority with COVID-19 relief? And I'm sure that's not the only thing that's in there. There's probably all kinds of other.
There is one other particular thing in this package that is of note. It is called the CASE Act, C-A-S-E, short for Copyright Alternative in Small Claims Enforcement. And what that does is it establishes a copyright claim tribunal within the United States Copyright Office. It's not a court, so it doesn't, but in theory, you won't have the costs associated with bringing a literal federal case to enforce your copyrights. But this is going to be some kind of smaller panel, smaller tribunal within the Copyright Office itself to provide an option to resolve copyright disputes outside the federal courts, which it seems to aim to make it easier for smaller creators to address their copyright infringements without the whole hullabaloo of a federal case. The fear around this seems to be one of the fears around this seems to be that this will trigger an avalanche of claims because people can troll with this. It would basically be an open invite to let copyright trolls file cases cheaply against whoever they want for whatever they want.
I was just going to suggest, could I, as a content creator, upload something to a really, really large, homogenous, dominant platform and then seek some sort of restitution for their profiteering off of my content? No, I know that wouldn't work, but I'm just putting it out there. It just seems like it's a backwards form of protection.
Alex, you have something to contribute to this as a lawyer?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of issues with this. Well, and on both sides, too. I think, the fact that it establishes this streamlined way to adjudicate copyright claims, I don't think is in and of itself a horrible thing, because copyright claims are, there's a lot of them all the time, right? I mean, there's too many to be asserted by individuals in federal court. And so having a streamlined process for it isn't in and of itself, I think, a terrible thing. But it will very likely be wielded against internet users in an unfair way. On the other hand, there is a way essentially to opt out of this process, but you have to do it, I believe, in a very specific time period. Otherwise, your rights are adjudicated with respect to that particular copyright. On the other hand, I could see this being kind of interesting from a revenge porn perspective, because using copyright law has been one way, and asserting copyright over your own images in a revenge porn situation has been one way to allow the courts to provide you a legal remedy, let's say, to reclaim those images, to shut them down, and to go after the offenders in a revenge porn situation. So this might give revenge porn victims a streamlined way to assert rights to their own images and get them taken down. Now, maybe, but we don't know. We don't know how this is going to work out in practice, and it does seem like it will certainly benefit larger corporations as opposed to ordinary internet users.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like this is just inviting that sort of thing, because we already see now with the copyright system and the laws and the processes being what they are now, copyright claims are roundly misused just as a trolling tool, a harassment tool. There are cases of people using the copyright claim system on YouTube to take down unfavorable reviews of their own movies or work or whatever, and it just seems like making it easier to misuse the system as a harassment tool is not doing anyone any favors.
Well, you know, in normal federal court, right, we have something called a slap suit. So if somebody sues you for something frivolous, you know, let's say, you know, asserting a claim of, you know, misuse of a trademark when it's obviously fair use, and the claim itself is designed essentially to try to bankrupt you, waste your money, and shut you down for whatever reason, right? So these slap suits, with SLAPP, S-L-A-P-P, stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. Now, I think what could be interesting with the CASE Act is if there were some legal mechanism or some remedy that was equivalent to the remedy that is involved with a slap suit for over-asserting your rights to a copyright or going after people without any justification, using this streamlined adjudicative process to do that. I think that would be a very interesting and innovative way to balance the rights of artists, corporations, etc., when it comes to copyright, and the rights of internet users to use those copyrighted materials, especially in the context of fair use.
All right. Well, we have to move on. I would like to read a couple of letters that we've gotten. We've been getting a lot of mail lately, which is great. It's good to see people writing. OTH@2600.com is our email address. Any comments on the show, any comments on technology, hacking in general, please write to us. Here's a letter that we got last week. I've been a fan of the show for many years, but my interest has been reignited lately. And I wanted to say thanks for providing an entertaining, thought-provoking program during such bleak times. I had a few quick thoughts about some topics. The BBS tapes have been a fascinating story. The history, what it took to get them into a functioning, good-sounding state, and the actual calls on the tapes themselves. In fact, we're going to play one or two in a minute. I'm looking forward to hearing more calls on the show, checking them out whenever you release them. I've been chewing over how they could be used in some sort of art/multimedia project, but haven't come up with anything just yet. And actually, a lot of people are thinking of creative ways that we can do something fun with all these bits of history from, I think, around the mid-90s is about where they average. Some of them might be a few years after that. Some of them might be a few years before that. But what do we do with all these recordings? Well, the ones that are meant to be public, obviously, they can be public. The ones that were private, it's a little bit unclear. And then, of course, there are all kinds of sounds and beeps and clicks and things like that, which most people would just discard, but not us. We find interest in all of those things because it's switching systems from mechanical era and all kinds of bygone technologies that we are always fascinated to study. Number two, I've also been enjoying the After Hours segment. It's called Overtime, but After Hours is another good word for it, I guess, which you've been streaming on YouTube. I've always wished that the show was longer than 1 hour, and now it is. Well, sort of, anyway. During last week's episode, Emmanuel mentioned an issue where messages to Gmail users were resulting in an error saying something like the Gmail user does not exist. Well, actually, it was just to me that I noticed that, and I noticed it one time. I was forwarding a message to myself, and it told me that I didn't exist. I cut and pasted it. So, you know, every time you do something involving Google, there's a line of people standing up to defend them. So if Google said that you don't exist, well, you must have done something wrong. So what I would have been accused of doing wrong was typing my own name wrong. So I cut and pasted it so that I could prove that I didn't do that, and it worked the second time. So therefore, I got you, Google. You said I didn't exist when I did. So that was my triumph for last week. Anyway, I received an email about this issue from my email provider, ProtonMail. It appears there was a widespread issue. They also covered the issue pretty extensively. I don't know whether or not this was related to the outage that Google had earlier that same week, or going out on a limb, whether it could potentially be related to the SolarWinds attack. Well, I don't think it was really related to either one of those. First of all, if you have an outage, then you get, you basically get a message saying that the service doesn't exist, not that the user on the service doesn't exist. For that kind of an outage to happen, Gmail itself would have had to have been somehow compromised. And while Gmail remained up, its user database disappeared. I don't think that is part of the outage that affected Google last week. I think it was simply an outage. You couldn't reach Google, and you got a timeout message of one sort or another. So I haven't gotten any kind of explanation. I've gotten a lot of people saying, oh, Google didn't do anything wrong, but something happened. Something happened. It's happened before, too. Many times I've forwarded mail to a Gmail box, and it's just disappeared someplace. Oddly enough, I can find it when I search for it, but it doesn't show up in any of the mailboxes, whether it's direct, promotions, social media, spam. So occasionally something just goes a little nuts, and it's okay. You know, that's part of the internet. That's part of technology. It's important to be able to admit when something isn't quite working right, and not just always point the finger and say, well, you must have done something wrong. Also on last week's episode, there was talk about the presidential alert system party that took place back in 2018. Ah, yes, it was good times. I attended that party. It was a lot of fun to get together, see how the alert behaved or didn't on the wide array of phones that people brought to the event. It was downstairs, back when we used to go into the radio station, and we have a cafe down there. Do we still have a cafe down there? Does anybody know?
Someone should check.
Commons Cafe, are you there, guys? Really hope you're doing okay, and look forward to seeing you again. But we gathered a whole bunch of people there, and everybody brought their cell phones. We lined them up on a table, and this was in the afternoon. It was the first and only test of the presidential alert system, and we waited to see what would happen. And, of course, all these phones started going off with all kinds of emergency alert tones, and we recorded the whole thing and broadcast part of it, and it was a lot of fun. That's what hackers do. So anyway, from what I recall, there was media present during the event, but I never saw it covered anywhere. Do you all know if anyone ever printed/aired/digitally published any stories about it? It would be fun to go back and revisit them. Does anybody remember? Was there any media? I know there was some kind of media there, but I don't remember if anybody actually did a story on it.
Apart from us, you mean?
Apart from us, yeah. We do count, but there might have been a story on like New York One or something, or they might have just had a moment of us and other moments of other people, because we weren't the only ones who were noticing this. Yes, Alex.
I think it was on New York One. Uh-huh. and maybe another local station too. Might have been WPIX. Was that 11? Channel 11? I think I can't remember.
You can't remember if WPIX is Channel 11 and you grew up in New York?
I think it is, isn't it?
You think it is? Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a long time since I've been watching.
Yeah, but it's been on the air every single day since like the 1940s. Do you remember the cop who used to do the kiddie programs in the afternoon? Maybe that's before your time. Rob, you would know this.
Indeed.
Okay,
yes, indeed.
I don't know what his name was, but he used to introduce all the children's programming. I think it was the Three Stooges, one of the shows. It's a part of New York. Growing up in New York is Channel 11, WPIX. It was a cop who that was back when you had announcers on television. not just audio announcers, but sometimes video announcers would come out and say, okay, kids, here's the next program.
I remember Jeannie Moose was interested.
Jeannie Moose? She's on CNN.
Yeah.
What does she have to do with this?
In the presidential alert thing that we did.
Oh, she was... Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, the presidential alert. Let's get back to the story we're talking about. Yeah, she was interested in it as well, but I don't know if she did a story on us.
I saw the flyer that we made. It's right around the corner.
Let's finish this letter. Yeah. Anyway, thanks for all that you do. I look forward to what you have in store for 2021. We plan on staying on topic more. We're going to try that. You know, something different. All that you have planned for on the air, the magazine, hopefully in-person events... thank you, PRD, for that wonderful letter. And you reminded us of the BBS tapes that we have that we're restoring. We've restored, but now we're going through them all. And let's see what we have to share with people from around 1995.
Yo, this is Dragon of 206, and I was looking at the new U.S. West telephones that are in Washington, and they seem to be red box proof. Because they've got like calling card slots and stuff, and this little high-tech feel to it, and like a little screen and everything, but I tried using a red box, you know, but it didn't seem to be working. And that's it.
That's it. Well, did you know the 206, that's your area code, Kyle? A Dragon?
It is.
Do you know Dragon?
No, not personally.
Did you know of Dragon?
Oh, I think everybody knows of Dragon.
there's a Dragon in every area code, I know, but that was 206 Dragon. And we're not trying to mock you, Dragon, if you're out there listening. We're just having, you know, fun listening to our old tapes from way back.
I know some of those U.S. West employees that worked on the telephone system were definitely chasing people that were making use of red boxes on the system. So... for my work at the Communications Museum, I've heard a lot of stories about what that was like.
Well, there were a lot of people using red boxes back then. And for those who don't know, red boxes were basically any device that you would hold up to a payphone and have it beep five times. And basically, that's all you needed to do to tell the phone that you put a quarter in. With a system that simple, everybody in the world was using it, and the phone companies had to redesign payphones and eventually get rid of them.
Yeah, it was a big deal. So there was a lot of energy put into getting the out-of-band signaling established.
Yes, Alex?
With respect to Dragon's comment there, he was complaining about it sounds like the voice path of the U.S. West telephones was probably disabled to discourage red boxing, but I believe there was a way to get around that. If I recall correctly, Mr. Firefly might remember this better than I do, but I think at the time when payphones had their voice path disabled, you could re-enable the voice path by dialing 1-800-288-2880, which was 1-800-ATT-ATT0 for the operator. That would then obviously allow you to talk to the operator. You would ask them to place a long-distance call for you, and then they would ask you to put the money in. You had to be more careful about it because you were doing your five beeps, your do-do-do-do-do, you know, while an operator
was
listening.
That's almost good enough to fool the phone. That's almost good enough, Alex.
I did this a lot when I was younger. This is all the product of a misspent youth, hanging out with you guys, quite frankly. But yeah, but then you just had to be very careful about it because there was an operator listening while you were redboxing. So you couldn't put the coins in too quickly, if I recall. Do you remember that, Rob?
Whoa. Hold on a sec. That's an actual red box you got there. Where did you get your hands on one of those, Rob?
Well, nowadays everything's an app. This is just an app on my smartphone. But yeah, there is a red box app, which is very nice and would have been nice to have back then. But
it would have been nice to have that night we did the show from the payphone.
Yes.
Instead of having that cup of quarters.
We did. But the fun thing about this too, I mean, it might have been just the voice path being disabled, which was happening, but also the caller mentioned that there was a calling card acceptor on the phone, which leads one to believe that this was probably one of the earlier phones that had the control circuitry in itself. It wasn't just a terminal for the phone system. It was actually doing some of the hard work on its own and had some kind of processor type capability in the phone, which might have been controlling things then. So getting past the voice path might not have worked on this particular phone, I'm sorry to say, 30-odd years later.
Yeah, it may have been just more of a priority to switch completely over to different payment methods and kind of move beyond that system entirely for overhead and other reasons, collection of coins and that sort of logistical aspect.
You know what a pain in the ass it was to collect coins? Because they are heavy. And they're not that valuable for the amount of space they take up. If you would see a step vans with a phone company logos on them, that's what they were for, to carry the immense amount of coins that were basically collected from all the payphones around cities. They don't do that anymore. And I like to think that the red boxers of the world saved them a lot of trouble by simply bypassing the quarter part of the whole thing. But Rob, can I ask you, does that app of yours, can it do a dime?
That app can do a dime. There's a dime
okay.
for you.
You notice that
there's an extra nickel just because I like you.
Okay, so if you do the dime and then you do the quarter, you'll notice the timing is a little bit different. Can you do a dime followed by a quarter? Yeah, much quicker. That's 35 cents there, folks.
If I remember off the top of my head, the pulses in the quarter were 33 milliseconds versus 66 for the nickel and dime.
You have a good memory. Okay, so let's listen to one more recording from the 90s, and then we will get into our main story of the day.
This is the Interceptor N423. It's Wednesday, October the 9th. Wow, there's so many messages. Oh, help. Jacko, I appreciate it. If everybody shared your attitude, a lot more could be accomplished on the board. Everybody wants to get on and trash the newcomers, but if you think back to when you started, unless you were conceived super elite, you pretty much started at the bottom also, and had to ask the same questions, because that's what it's about, asking questions, gaining knowledge, and sharing what you know with everybody else. But somebody said I didn't know anything, so I was just talking out my ass. But Jackal, I don't know much about the Juno system. I'll check and see if I can find anybody that knows anything. If I get anything useful on that for you, I'll post it here. Looking for something to leave. I don't like getting on here and not leaving anything. I can't find anything useful. This is the Interceptor 423. See ya.
Thank you very much, Interceptor. I guess we can figure out what year that was. Wednesday, October 9th. Whatever year had that in the mid-90s, that's what year that was. Again, more talk about Juno. In fact, we got a lot of mail from people. We got some mail from people using Juno somehow. I thought Juno went out of business, but people are still using Juno. A lot of memories, a lot of history there.
Absolutely. And it's a lot of fun, too, to just listen to that hacker attitude of like, yeah, share your information. That's what it's all about. I remember that whole divide between people who thought they were too cool for school and elite, and like, you're not allowed to hang out with me if you're not elite enough. And, you know, everyone was a beginner at some point, and everyone started somewhere. And that's the right attitude.
Very true. Very true. Okay, so getting into the story everybody is talking about, that of course is the SolarWinds hack. Oh my God, it's something that is affecting thousands, hundreds of thousands of users, if not many, many more than that. Cisco, Intel, NVIDIA, Belkin, VMware, they've all had their computers on their networks infected with the malware. And of course, there could be far, far more. SolarWinds had stated that fewer than 18,000 companies were impacted, as if that number is supposed to somehow be reassuring. Fewer than 18,000. Okay. Even attempted to hide the list of clients who use the infected software. More recent news that takes some of SolarWinds' big name clients from possibly affected to confirmed affected. This from a story at The Verge. At the moment, the big tech companies have the same story boiling down to, we're investigating, but we don't think this has impacted us. But as has been repeatedly reported, and similar to the 2016 hack of the DNC's emails, it can take a long time for the impacts of a hack to be fully realized. And once hackers are inside a system, it can also be very difficult to tell if they're fully gone. Exacerbating the issue is the fact that investigators found another hacking group that had broken into SolarWinds using a similar exploit. This attack, dubbed Supernova, was at first thought to be part of the main attack, but investigators now think it was executed by a second, less sophisticated group. Now, there are all kinds of reasons why a hacking group might want to get into a big tech company's systems, including access to future product plans or employee and customer information that could be sold or held for ransom, assuming they actually went looking for that info. But it's also possible these companies were only collateral damage as these hacking groups went after governmental agencies, ones that happened to share the same SolarWinds provided IT management systems. Now, at the moment, it doesn't seem like any of these companies are particularly worried. Compare that to the U.S. government's Computer Security Organization, which announced that every federal agency should power down its SolarWinds systems immediately. Now, SolarWinds is a technology company whose products are used by a number of federal civilian agencies for network management. The U.S. government often contracts with private companies like this because their expertise in product development is far beyond what the government can develop on its own. Now, some members of Congress have consistently criticized the potential security risks of using this kind of software, particularly without a thorough security review first. But protecting these networks is also the responsibility of the government, and we're already seeing lawmakers like Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, say there needs to be an in-depth review of software security practices. And of course, this is going to be a big challenge for Biden. Foreign adversaries are consistently attempting to infiltrate U.S. networks and are only becoming more sophisticated in their ability to do so. Alex, any thoughts on this?
Oh, I've got a lot of thoughts on this. And, you know, I think it's quite interesting, too, because we dove into this, I think, head first last week and mentioned a lot of minutiae and the details, you know, certain things like the very weak password that was used to secure the update server. And these are things that have created or gained a lot of momentum over the past week and really snowballed the discussion, I think, on SolarWinds. You know, and I love Senator Wyden as much as anybody else. And in fact, you know, he's married to Nancy Bass Wyden, by the way, who, for our listeners may recall, is the owner of the Strand Bookstore here in New York. And I think Senator Wyden is generally right on when it comes to privacy issues, especially the use of geolocation data and really protecting people's privacy. But I will say I do not entirely agree with his assessment and his colleagues' assessment of this failure to review third-party software in the federal government. This particular type of attack was essentially undetectable from any kind of risk mitigation standpoint because the updates themselves came from the actual infrastructure build server of SolarWinds. So for all intents and purposes, those updates that were being pushed out to these 18,000 customers that you had mentioned looked like legitimate updates. And the right thing to do is to update your software when there is an update to be had. This is what we're all told to do, and it's what you should do. So everybody was doing what they should have been doing, and this breach still occurred. And I think that, yeah, there is a bigger issue with third-party risk and software needing to be coded securely from the outset, right? This whole privacy and security by design, DevSecOps endeavor that companies have right now. But this would have been an incredibly difficult breach to have avoided because of the nature of the way in which it was affected. It was done extraordinarily well. There was a lot of great tradecraft that was implemented. And I think this gets to a larger issue here, which is ordinarily we probably wouldn't even hear of something like this. And that's because a company that does incident response is obviously well known for its cybersecurity related threat intelligence. FireEye was the one researching its own breach and found this particular attack vector, having reported on it, sent out the IOCs, the indicators of compromise, and we all realized, oh my God, this is much wider breach than anybody had anticipated. So if it wasn't for FireEye, this entire operation probably would have gone on undetected for God knows how long. And even if it was detected in the federal government, because if you look at these targets, they're targeting Treasury, they're targeting energy. They were apparently the threat actors behind it, ostensibly Russia, were monitoring the email accounts of top-ranking U.S. Treasury officials. That's espionage. That's intelligence collection. This is the kind of stuff that when it happens, and if there was a breach, we probably wouldn't know about it because it would be classified. So because this this breach occurred and was investigated by a private sector company who then released the information. I think we're only hearing about this now. My concern is that there are far more of these types of incidents that we do not learn about because they are classified, and perhaps there isn't enough information sharing that comes from the government and especially the intelligence community back to the private sector. Obviously, groups like CISA, where Brian Krebs, was the head of CISA, who was recently fired by
Christopher Krebs.
Krebs. Yeah, Brian Krebs is a journalist. Yes, there's all different types of Krebs in cybersecurity these days. But yeah, Chris Krebs was the fired head of CISA, essentially fired for doing his job and not towing the administration's line. I think there's a lot of great strides being made in terms of public and private intelligence sharing. But for something like this, I really wonder, if it wasn't for FireEye, how much information would the public actually have known by this?
Well, it's interesting because from what I'm seeing here, SolarWinds was not used on networks that carry classified data, only on networks carrying unclassified data. Energy Department on Friday clarified earlier reports to stress the hackers only access business networks, and it has not impacted the mission essential national security functions of the department, including the National Nuclear Security Administration. One insider confirmed the nuclear weapons networks are separate from those front-facing business operations networks, saying there's no need for anyone to have their hair on fire. That is a quote. And that is the smart way of doing it, obviously. But former top congressional intelligence staffer Andy Kaiser said, highly skilled hackers can sometimes turn a foothold on one network into a jumping off point to penetrate another, even if the two networks are physically separated by what's known as an air gap. Once embedded in an unclassified network, Kaiser agreed, or said rather, advanced persistent threat actors could potentially move into more sensitive networks or gain access credentials to classified networks, particularly when given months or years. And by all accounts, that's exactly how long these people have been in the system. Alex.
Yeah, and going back, if you look at some of the timelines that various security-related companies have put out, I mean, this last week we knew that this may have started in October of 2019. Now it's going back further to August of 2019. And I have to say, I have, with our DNS intelligence platform that I created over the last several years, I investigated some of the domains that were at issue and did find very similar domain names to the very famous one that was being used with the SolarWinds, the avssvcloud.com domain that was used in most of the SolarWinds attacks. We found several other similar domains that go back. One actually had a direct nexus back to Russia as well. And I would invite people who are interested in that. We're happy to share this information with them as a potential IOC or indicator of compromise. And I invite anybody to contact me about that. In the hacker spirit, we're willing to share that information. But the companies that you mentioned, Emmanuel, in particular, Cisco, Belkin, and VMware, I mean, this goes right to the point that you were just making, which is they may have used the access that they had with some companies to jump over, obviously, into these companies, into Cisco, Belkin, VMware. They developed Cisco and Belkin networking hardware and software as well. And so if they were able to establish a foothold, let's say in Cisco or Belkin, that may compromise the trust that we have in everything from enterprise networking equipment, enterprise level routers, to home networking equipment, stuff that's sort of commercial off the shelf things that you would buy at Best Buy, your Belkin routers. And when everybody's working from home these days because of the global health crisis in which we find ourselves, that becomes a major, major problem. And the same thing with VMware. VMware is virtual machineware, very, very commonly used, again, probably almost more commonly than SolarWinds is found in large enterprises. VMware is used all over the world. If they were able to compromise the build infrastructure, and I don't think there's any indication that they have yet, but assuming hypothetically they're able to compromise the build infrastructure of VMware and push out a similar attack by way of a software update, that would, again, be absolutely massive. And it becomes very difficult to root these guys out of your networks because their TTPs, their tactics, techniques, and procedures were apparently to use the access that SolarWinds Orion had to certain boxes to create additional privileged accounts. And when they had those additional privileged accounts, then they would go after the certificate signing token for SAML, or the security assertion markup language, which is used essentially to transfer identity-related tokens from one place to another. And when they were able to essentially issue their own tokens, which were signed by the right certificate, they could then get access to cloud services of these enterprise customers, cloud services of these major organizations, or the Department of Treasury, the governmental organizations. So I think it's going to take a very, very long time to unwind exactly what the extent of these types of breaches were. And given the level of sophisticated tradecraft and the nature of these breaches and how they piggybacked, essentially, like we said last week, it's like they were underneath a bus that was going into a secure compound. I think it's going to be very difficult to unwind these breaches because the threat actors themselves may have engaged in a good amount of anti-forensic behavior. They may have been very adept at covering up their tracks.
They absolutely did. Some of the stuff I read was the ability for some of the software to detect based on network connectivity. If it could reach certain IPs, it would say, okay, I'm in a sandbox where potentially someone's looking at exactly what I'm doing as in a diagnostic way, and that then ran some part of that software that protected it from further evaluation.
Well, I think what you're outlining, Alex, underscores the significance of this, because SolarWinds is just so all-encompassing. Everybody uses them. They're the solution everyone turns to, and that is the weakness, because so many just turn all their problems over to SolarWinds, and then when there's a big problem with SolarWinds, everybody has the same big problem. That is the security hole right there. And what we're seeing now is the result of just relying on this company to take care of all of the security issues and assume that it's not going to come back and bite you in the end. Now that it has, though, and now that it does appear that Russia is behind it, even though Trump refuses to admit that, and I can't say I'm surprised that he's not seeing it, What's the reaction? Is this, Alex, do you consider this to be an act of war, as some are saying?
No, I absolutely do not.
Good.
I
don't think. Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, we haven't seen any type of kinetic effect on the population here. They haven't used this to take down hospital systems. I think what we're seeing here is a rare glimpse into the tradecraft of a very sophisticated nation targeting the United States, and I think that the United States, very likely, and I'm not saying I have direct knowledge of this, but look, we're a sophisticated country. We probably do very similar things to other countries. And again, you know, this is not the first time an attack like this has happened. We obliquely hinted at this, and I looked this up after our discussion last week, but there was an attack very similar that happened in Ukraine. I think it was in 2017, and it was a very prominent accounting software that was used in Ukraine. The build infrastructure of that accounting software was compromised, and a malicious update was pushed out to all of these accounting firms. And it was ostensibly the Russians that performed this type of tradecraft again several years ago. So I think, you know, we're seeing some similar TTPs here, but it's a great attack vector, right? Because you are hiding essentially right in plain sight. And you're exactly right, Emmanuel. I think precisely right. That because everybody relies on this is the lowest common denominator of something that is found in all these major enterprises, as well as the federal government. So if you get access to that, you've got the keys not only to the kingdom, but, you know, to the universe.
Yeah, and what we're seeing here, I think it's a form of espionage. It's a very sophisticated form of espionage, and that's how some security experts are viewing it. The Australian-based legal expert Cassandra Steer says hacking like this, especially to this extent, might go beyond espionage, but we don't really have anything to say it's unlawful under international law. And as you said, Alex, let's be clear, the U.S. has engaged in similar activity, just never to this extent. But I have to say, you know, Stuxnet was definitely something that was malicious and caused all kinds of damage. And when you do that, when you cause damage, or you mentioned hospitals, when you do something that actually hurts people, that's where the crime is. But this, you know, invading systems and basically showing the weaknesses, not because you're trying to unveil them, but you're actually, you have some kind of modus operandi, that is part of the game. That's part of the game you're playing. And to call this an act of war, I think, is highly irresponsible, because it's not. It also it's a disservice to people who have fought in actual wars. So let's be careful with the rhetoric here.
But isn't it an escalation in tactics? I mean, doesn't this make it fair game to do this right back and at the same, or let's just think American, more of it at this scale?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that other countries are doing the same thing, and that other countries are trying to do the same thing. But it's a different type of battlefield, if you want to even carry that analogy. Rob, go ahead.
This is also, I think, a great example of how irresponsibly we've handled the gift of the internet. When it was put together, it has its origins in government projects to create a decentralized networking system, something without the single points of failure, something that if one chunk goes down, the rest take over for it, and everything just keeps working. But we're now at a point, 30, 40 years later, where we have allowed commercial interests to monopolize such huge swaths of the technical environment. How much of the internet now goes through Amazon Cloud, hosting, for example, Google or anything like that? And how many all use the same equipment? I mean, that Rogues Gallery, Cisco, Intel, NVIDIA, Belkin, VMware, if you're sitting in front of a computer that is attached to the internet, you're probably using at least two or three of those companies' products.
Right. Their security problem becomes your security problem, no matter how good your security is.
Absolutely. And everyone suffers as a result.
Now, here's the most stunning thing about this, according to this story in Slate. Basically, at least six federal agencies, including the State Department, Homeland Security, National Nuclear Security Administration, all affected by this. The most stunning thing is not how sophisticated the attack was. It's that this has been known for so long. As far back as 1997, a presidential commission concluded that the information networks controlling much of our economy and society were vulnerable to cyber attacks. The ability of foreign powers to launch these hacks and do us harm, the report went on, is real. It is growing at an alarming rate, and we have little defense against it. Now, basically, a year before that report, the Pentagon's Defense Science Board released a report on information warfare defense, warning that our increasing dependency on vulnerable networks amounted to a recipe for a national security disaster. And I think that's where we are right now. Its authors recommended more than 50 actions to be taken over the next 5 years at a cost of $3 billion. None of the actions was taken. Now, these reports are only repeating a document signed all the way back in 1984 by President Ronald Reagan, called National Policy on Telecommunications and Automated Information System Security, which concluded that new computer networks, which were just hitting the market, were highly susceptible to interception, unauthorized electronic access, and related forms of technical exploitation by foreign spies, terrorist groups, and criminal elements. That study was prompted by the movie War Games. War Games, yes, about a high-tech whiz teenager who unwittingly hacks into the North American Air Defense Command's early warning computers, nearly sets off a nuclear war. After Reagan saw the movie, he asked his top general, could something like this really happen? I'm not going to do the voice. So basically, we're looking at lessons that just have not been learned over the decades. Now, security's a lot better than it used to be, but vast networks have been left exposed in one way or another, and dedicated hackers who very much want to get inside these networks and have the resources of a nation state will figure out a way. And there's one point a little more than 20 years ago when much of this problem could have been avoided. Soon after that 1997 report warning of possible cyber attacks, Richard Clark, President Clinton's counterterrorism coordinator, proposed setting mandatory cybersecurity requirements for industries in critical infrastructure. Economic sector is vital to the functioning of a modern society, including telecommunications, electrical power, gas and oil, banking and finance, transportation, water supply, emergency services. Most of the industries were and still are private companies, and their executives, who abhorred all forms of regulation, resisted the proposal. And that's where we are now. Yes, Alex.
No. Yeah, no doubt. I mean, look, and it's obviously worse because our interdependencies have grown exponentially since those times. And this is a supply chain issue, as somebody mentioned on Off the Hook Overtime last week as well, and I think rightly so. But it's also an issue of third-party risk, and how do we mitigate that risk? How do we push
Guys,
it down?
I'm sorry, I didn't look at the clock. We're out of time. We have to go. Join us on Overtime, Channel 2600 on YouTube. We'll be there at 8 o'clock. And give us a call, 802-321-4225. We will see you next week. Write to us, oth@2600.com. Have a good night.
And ice cream castles in the air, and feathered canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way.
Complicated times. Sometimes it seems like important voices get left out, and sometimes it's hard to know who to trust. But one thing's for sure. For more than 60 years, WBAI has been your go-to for independent, non-commercial, free speech programming. Join the WBAI family as a BAI buddy in the name of your favorite show today and support radio you can trust. It's easy. Just go to WBAI.org or call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. When you become a WBAI buddy, you show your support for great programs on politics, news, the arts, music, and culture. you show your support for real free speech radio. Go to WBAI.org or call 516-620-3602 now. Don't wait. You know these times are too important. Please give as generously as you can. It's simple to make a recurring monthly donation, and it only takes a minute. Just go to WBAI.org and click Ways to Donate. Unlike living in New York, it is that easy. WBAI has spoken up for New Yorkers for more than 60 years. Now, it's time to speak up for WBAI. Go to WBAI.org to support radio you can trust. Give to WBAI today. Be heard.